And your leaky joke shining like a sun ray.
Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We're playing Angelique Jo's Move On Up, and then we're joined by the director and cast of wonderful production at Multi-Ethnic Theater in association with the custom-made theater of August Wilson's Jitney. So we're going to finish playing the rest of the song, and then I'm going to introduce our guests. Conversation. Your play is just simply fantastic. So we are joined in the studio by the director, Lewis Campbell. Good morning, Lewis. How are you?
I'm fine.
Excellent, excellent. Robin Hughes, you portray Rena. Are you with us this morning? No, no Robin? Okay. Stuart Elwin Hall, who plays Sheely, are you with us?
I'm here, yes.
Excellent. Oh, you have such a nice phone, a nice radio voice.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe that's why you're so successful with the numbers game that you run out of the Jitney office. Trevor Nigel Lawrence, who plays Fielding, are you with us? No, Trevor, not here. Okay. Is Anthony Pride, who plays Fillmore, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Excellent. Let's see. Benny Lewis, who plays Becker, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Charles, I know you're with us. You play Dub. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
And let's see. David Stewart, are you with us? You play Booster? No, David's not with us. Okay. Vernon, who plays Vernon Amadeus, you play Turnbull. Are you with us?
Yes, I am, Wanda. Good morning.
Good morning. You're sounding kind of far away, Vernon. Say something
else. Oh, can you hear me now?
I can hear you, but you sound like you're really far away.
Oh, well, I'm at work on my job's phone.
Oh, okay. Are you going to be able to be with us for a little bit, or do we need to let you talk first?
Well, it would be nice if I can talk first.
Okay. All
righty. That's the problem.
We're all working people.
Yeah, I know. I was reading about that. Did I call everyone's name, or did I leave anybody out?
Fabian Hurd, who plays Youngblood.
Fabian, I thought they said you weren't going to be able to be with us. Oh, that's awesome.
No. This is Stuart. So I would say Fabian is the only person that you missed.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Okay, cool. All righty.
Some of our working men are really working, and they have conflicts.
All righty. So what I was thinking, maybe we could just sort of go around and everyone could talk about the play. And in this particular episode in the Centennial 10-play cycle, many of you are not new to August Wilson's plays. And so maybe we'll have Lewis, maybe we have you start as director in design of that wonderful set. And why don't you talk a little bit about multi-ethnic theater and you know, the idea of bringing August Wilson to the San Francisco Bay Area in August, and mounting Jitney at this particular time, because I was looking at just sort of the themes that are running through Jitney, and they're so apropos. We've got the incarceration of the youth, we've got the dismantling of really stable, strong black communities through gentrification and urban renewal, in quotation marks. And then you've got this underground transportation service that's happening. It sort of reminds you of, what happened when during the Montgomery bus boycott, when black folks were walking and giving each other rides. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, give us sort of the context, and then we can jump right into, maybe we'll let Vernon go first, since he has a real important role as sort of the resident archivist. I mean, he knows everybody's story, but doesn't always get it right,
that's true. He's in everyone's business, and he's almost kind of like a narrator of sorts, because he knows everyone's business, or he might not know it correctly, but in his mind, he talks what he knows. He's been around with Becker for at least 20 years, because he was there when his son Booster went to jail, and he's there now when he gets out. He tells the story of how Booster came to be incarcerated. He gives Rena false information about her sister and Youngblood fooling around. He's in Dub's business about Fielding and his money. Hello. And he's just all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lewis, do you want to give us sort of like the context for the play and why Jitney, why now, why this particular production at Multi-Ethnic Theater? Oh, you have to go now? Oh. Okay.
I have to thank Benny Lewis, who plays Becker, for the why Jitney and why August in August. He's the one that planted that seed. He said, "Well, we got to do Jitney." And a lot of the other actors said, "We got to do Jitney." This is a cast that really holds together. They are hugging buddies. And August in August just seemed like turned out to be a natural. This is the fourth August Wilson play that we've done. We began with Fences, then we did Gem of the Ocean, which is the not the first that he wrote, but the first in the 10-decade 20th century cycle. and which reaches back clear to slave days and the Middle Passage and even life in Africa. So it is the roots of the cycle. And we've done that, and we've also done the play that comes right after that, Joe Turner's Come and Gone. So those are the three that we've already done. And now we've done a fourth, and we plan to do the next six. By 2020, we will have done all 10 of August Wilson's plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was really, really, the synchronicity of it was just awesome because in San Francisco, you all are performing Jitney, and in Oakland at the Flight Deck, just for one weekend, Lower Bottom Players was doing Two Trains Running, which is the play, I think, right before Jitney.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, wow, that's so awesome. I mean, how often can you get, like, two plays, August Wilson plays, consecutively insofar as their chronology in the same, you know, sort of region? I just thought that was just really, really great. So why don't, since now hopefully no one has to leave out, Benny, Lewis,
yes.
Why don't you tell us about your Jitney station and tell us about your character. And he is just, you know, he's got compassion about some things and others. He's just like, I don't know, he seems to be really hurt by what happened with his son who he had sort of invested all of his resources into, you know, both psychologically as well as emotionally, and then he's, like, really disappointed and doesn't know. Seems like, yeah, there's just nowhere for him to go with that.
Yeah. Well, the character I play, Becker, he reminds me of a conversation that I used to have with my father when I was coming up. I didn't realize at the time all the sacrifices and stuff that he had made, that he was making every day to raise the family, because I was so young. And so August Wilson just strikes at the heart of that, of fathers all over who are doing the same thing. All of the characters in the play, Fabian, what he's trying to do, raise a family and buy a house, and Rio's trying to keep her family together her way, and it just strikes at the heart of where everybody lives. And a lot of things in the play resonate with me, too. My father worked in a steel mill in Stockton, California, Pittsburgh Des Moines Steel Company. And when I was coming up, they tore down my neighborhood. And for years, there was nothing but just flat ground. So there's a lot of things in the play that resonates with me, that comes out in my character. And I just love the words. I love the musicality of the writing of August Wilson. And I got to say, Lewis, we knew that he would knock it out the park when he directs August Wilson or when he directs anything. I mean, he can find these little nuggets that's hidden away that we don't even see that, you know, he makes us go back and uncover and in rehearsal and stuff to bring all these little intimate details out. So it's a great, and we got a great cast, got some great people, some very talented actors that are in the play that is just fun to work with, just great to be there every day when we come to rehearsal. We come dragging in, but at the end of the day, we're all laughing and hugging. It's just a great experience to work with all these very talented and warm performers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why don't you speak before we move on to another member of your cast? Talk about your set. Talk about the Jitney set. It's homey, but there are rules, and everyone sort of has to pay their dues to be able to run cabs out of the office. And then you have this old-fashioned phone with a dial. And, yeah, it's like, wow. And then men, you know, like, it's so cool the way the set is arranged, because I was, like, sitting almost on top of the table where when the opening scene opens, two members of the cast and the Jitney office are playing checkers, and I'm like, wow, I mean, I can actually see what they're doing. It's like really nice. I mean,
well those two,
yeah,
care,
great.
That's Vernon Medeiros and
an hour
Bird.
Of rehearsal.
Yeah, and the set, I can't take any credit for that. That's Lewis's design. You know, that's Scott of Lewis. And I don't know how he does it, but he scraps these pieces together, even this, and you know, it just works. So I can't take any, you know, you have to talk to Lewis about the set design. But it's just, it's a beautiful space. It's warm. It's intimate. And the rules that Becker set down is, you know, the rules that, that you have to work by to keep the company going. And we have a Young Bloods played by Fabian Hurd. He doesn't want to haul, carry passengers because it'll mess up his car. And, you know, so you have to come down hard. And other situations you have to kind of be soft. But I love the flexibility of Becker. I love the way he can move in and out emotionally of dealing with each and every different situation. So you have a lot of room to explore and to show you the different sides of Becker, and I love that character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David, talk about your character Booster, who we don't even know exists for quite a while, and it's like all of a sudden, oh, wow, you know, Becker has a son, really, and he's been in prison for 20 years. Really? Like, wow. Well, your backstory is, like, amazing. And that relationship between your father and August Wilson, you know, because of his estranged relationship with his dad, there's always these relationships, you know, like August Wilson is really, he writes about black men, you know, like,
yes.
Like men. And, every, you know, he throws in a woman, you know, like Rena's sort of like, she's not quite an afterthought, but it's not really about her. It's about... I think Youngblood's relationship to his maybe son and to these other men who are older and, quote, supposedly wiser. But that's sort of like a negotiable kind of up-in-the-air kind of concept. Yeah, so David, talk about Booster, and then Fabian, please join in and talk about your character, Youngblood, who is, man, he's like exploding all over the set.
Yeah.
I don't think Fabian's with us, is he?
Oh, David's not with us? Oh, okay. All right, go ahead, Fabian. you can talk about Youngblood, because Youngblood, you know, unlike Booster, you know, he doesn't have a prison record, and it's like, which is fabulous, unless I miss something. So what kept him out of prison, considering his real volatile kind of attitude, like he wasn't taking anything from anybody? Was that just something that the bravado, was that something that he just expresses among his own people? And like, you know, and when he steps out of the office onto the street, he's another person? That's how he could work at UPS too, or what?
Well, Fabian has a little boy, and he has a relationship with a woman that he's trying to make work, and that is so important to him, and it just overcomes all of the other issues that might prop up.
Mhm. Yeah. But then, then Booster, any of you who want to talk about his character, I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, did he? I just love, you know, when he's telling his father about, you know, about being big and how he saw him as filling the room, and then he saw that shrink because of you know, racism and prejudice and the things that he had to take as a black man in society, you know, so that he could feed his family and keep a roof over their head.
This is Stuart.
One of the functions.
Yeah,
one of the functions of Booster is to actually give Becker a chance to argue the point of view of the black father who has to make sacrifices like that and wear the mask, so to speak.
Yeah. Stuart?
Yes, I mean, to dovetail on what Lewis was saying, this is a theme that August Wilson puts in all of his plays. As you mentioned earlier, his estrangement with his own father, which, you know, very much resonated in his displays on stage. Booster is the new generation coming in who's basically challenging the tenets of the older generation of his father. And he admits that he's made some mistakes, obviously one very large mistake. But he's also getting his father to acknowledge the mistakes he's made, which is what it's the job of the younger generation. That's what they're supposed to do in order to progress the society as a whole. And the fact that there is no, shall we say, neat and tidy resolution to this by the end of the play gives you an idea of that fact. There's no neat and tidy resolution to this anywhere. I mean, this is something that all, not only just men have to work out, but mothers and daughters need to work this out as well. Yes, but certainly fathers and sons, and certainly in the black family these days, fathers and sons need to work that out. It's probably more germane now than it was even back in the 1970s because of all of the complexities of racism as we see it at this point.
Yeah, this is Benny Lewis again. Dave Stewart plays Booster, my son, and from day one, we hit it off in rehearsal. I mean, he's such a powerful, strong. A lot of people don't know. He could only come on the weekends to rehearse, and he came like 100 miles, and he would go back from San Francisco to San Jose to work, and then go back to Stockton, come back to San Francisco, and spend the night with the friends so he could come and rehearse. And he's such a strong, powerful actor. And I love the repartee that we have together. And it started from the beginning, from the first rehearsal. He just drags you along. He just, he just pulls it out of you. He's such a strong individual. And the eye contact we make, we don't even know where we're going a lot of times. We have the words, but the emotion is so powerful that it's just fun to fly. Just fly. You know, we don't even know what we're going to. We know that we have the script, but it's just letting it all out, and he can just rip and rock and rip. And I love it. I love it. I love it. People say, where do you get the stamina? Where do you get the energy? Well, it comes from the words of August Wilson. It comes from the heart, from both of us, and it's just a really beautiful part to be part of it. So I'm going to let somebody else talk now.
Yeah, it's really, that is so true, Mr. Lewis. The ensemble is really important, to most of Wilson's plays, but specifically to this one because of the set. You know, you're in this office most of the time, and, that's where, you go off, then you go off, for the to take the fares, going wherever, taking people to the airport or helping them move or whatever they're doing, and then they come back to the office. So we get to see you all quite a bit, sort of in your, off, times, waiting for the call to come in and, looking at sort of the order, like when you come in, like whose call is it going to be, and just sometimes letting, how the phone just rings and rings and rings, and which is kind of interesting. But I was wondering, I had another thought, but I can't remember what it is. I was thinking about, Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying and how the young person who is being tried for a murder he didn't commit, the teacher in the town who had gone away and comes back is asked by the young person's grandmother, I believe, to help this young person sort of come into the fullness of his manhood before they kill him so that he dies as a man. That's the lesson. And then I think about, your relationship, Charles, the dub, who's, he's a longtime jitney driver. He's also a Korean War veteran, in contrast to Fabian Hurd's Youngblood, who is a driver, but he's also a Vietnam veteran. So you both have that, you know, you've been the war kind of thing in there, the discipline of being in the military and in two different wars. And I don't know if the country, you know, was, you know, I don't know if the segregation, you know, of the armed force, of the military was going on, you know, in the Korean War, and it got better in the Vietnam War. But, you know, both wars, all wars have their issues. And so I was wondering, Charles, if you could talk about sort of your character and his role as sort of like the peacemaker. Like, there are places you don't go, and you tell you tell us, like,
yeah,
I don't talk about this, I don't talk about this, I don't talk about this.
Yeah, Dub is he's sort of the backbone of the station, sort of a mentor to Youngblood. He's been to the Korean War. He knows about the, you know, and that's why he encourages Youngblood, because Youngblood just got out of the Vietnam War. And he's explaining to him that nothing has really changed. It's basically the same. But he's like the backbone. When things are going wrong, you notice everybody looks to Dub to what we're going to do. You know, he's kind of the one who knows the way. He has hope. Even though they're getting ready to tear down the neighborhood, he still has hope that things will somehow get better.
And he's the gadfly, too.
Yeah. I love playing that character. When Lewis cast me in that part, he says you fit it well because you've been through that. You've been through a lot of stuff that Dub has been through. Like I was in the fire department for 30 years and going through the racism in the fire department and integrating the schools in the South. I remember that very conversation having with my father when I came to California in 73 and I went back home to visit and I thought I got liberated and we're at the service station one day getting some gas and this young white guy who I went to school, who I was in school with, who would call me names and all those sort of things, and he came to the car to ask my dad how much gas did he need, and my dad said to him, he was speaking to him like, yes sir, no sir, and that just really, I couldn't understand that. And we had that conversation, not to extend that Booster and Becker had, but we had that very, very conversation. So I have to give props out to Lewis for doing this play, having the courage to do it, and being the director that he is.
Yeah. So when your father, you saw your father, saying yes sir and no sir to this young white guy in the service station, you know, that you went to school with, did and sort of reflecting on what Booster said about his father, Becker, when he saw what he did, you know, when, you know, the rent was due and you know, he had to negotiate with, you know, with this the man who owned the house. Did your father shrink?
I thought it was shrinking at the time, but as I got to be an older man, I realized that's what he had to do to survive. You just couldn't go around, you know, if you want to call it, they call it disrespecting white people, because you had to move off the sidewalk and all that kind of stuff when I came through. So basically, he did what he had to do for us to survive.
Yeah.
You can see how we assembled a cast of men and the one woman who were able to bring their life experience to the play. And the emphasis on the acting was make it look like not. Don't let it look like acting. Just make it look like life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then one nice thing about you know, Wilson's play cycle, but within the, you know, the characters, sometimes he brings certain characters, like you see them in one cycle and then they appear again in another cycle. And I was wondering if any of these characters in Jitney are characters that we've seen before or we'll see again in other cycles.
One interesting thing is that Turnbow mentions that now that the Jitney station might be closing down, he has lined up another job because Bono has cancer and is in the hospital. Well, this is an offstage character. Lots of offstage characters in this play and lots of offstage places in this play. And we really had to emphasize those realities, create a life beyond the set, but a world, you know. And our actors knew where everything around outside was, beginning with Turnbow's car just outside and all of the other neighborhoods that are mentioned and all of the other women that are mentioned. Lots of women are mentioned. Only one appears on stage. But I forgot my train of thought, where I began.
I think this is Benny Lewis again. The one thing is the garage is located at 1839 Wiley. Wiley is an address that keeps coming up in August Wilson's plays because Wiley used to be an underground railroad destination where, you know, escaped slaves would spend the night before they went on. And in Jim of the Ocean, that was 1839 Wiley. This station, and then in Radio Golf, there's another mention of 1839 Wiley. So for some reason, that address keeps coming up because of what happened at the Underground Railroad Station, what impact it had on the African community where, you know, escaped slaves would be hidden until it was safe to pass them on.
And now, I have to confess that August Wilson did not specify 1839 Wiley as the address of the Jitney Station, but we chose it and we put it on the door of the station. We chose it as a peon, as a tribute to.
Oh, Lewis, I thought that was the yeah. Well, that's what you said to me. So I'm sorry, everybody. I apologize. I thought it was.
No, that's a good choice
because that address is important, and I chose it because I knew it would be inspirational. And every time we think of 1839 Wiley, we'd be thinking of that house that was a place on the Underground Railroad and the matriarch, the 239-year-old matriarch who had seen life in Africa and on the Middle Passage and all of that. And so you mentioned the set, as important as that set is, what is more than more important is the world beyond the set that we create, the world, the Hill District in Pittsburgh and the world beyond the Hill District, over to the airport, over to the prison, and you know, over to the neighborhood.
East Liberty.
Youngblood hopes to take his soon-to-be bride, and the world beyond, the world of the past and the hoped-for world of the future. So, and that's one of the things that the theater does, is it shows you a microcosm and then invites you to see beyond the microcosm to the macrocosm and to yourself existing in that macrocosm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to allow Anthony Pride to speak about Fillmore, and then I want to get some more. I want to talk a little bit more to you, Stuart, about your character, because the two, you know, Sheely and Fillmore. For one thing, Sheely, he always comes in dressed really nicely, particularly when he has on that red jacket. That is like, wow, stunning. I mean, it's like really stunning. Looks really good. And then Anthony, your character, you know, he's been working steadily for like 7 years, I believe. He's at a hotel doorman, and he always, you know, he comes in flashing money. It's not big money, but it's money. I really like the thing when you blow the money, you like blowing your money. That was funny. So Anthony, talk about Fillmore.
Well, I believe in the way that I've played Fillmore is that there's about three or four specific purposes that Fillmore has. Number one, he's there to introduce the actual era and the time that we're in. One of my lines is that I've been there since 1970, where May 16th, 1971, and I've been there for 6 years. So if you can do the math, you know that's 1977. Number two, I like to play this as I am the opposite of what Youngblood is doing. I'm really the kind of like the foil. And in Act One, I am everything that Youngblood has done in his past, because I'm out going out to parties. I'm drinking and blowing my money away. I'm hanging out. And number two, in Act Two, I am kind of like what Youngblood's alternate future could have been if he had not had changed his ways and started doing something different. So you could actually see how Youngblood could have ended up a possible alternate future if he had not changed his ways. Number three, I am the customer. I'm the face of the customer. So whatever time you hear someone calling on the phone, I represent all those customers that come in to the Jitney Station. I'm the only customer that does come in, but I'm kind of like the representation of all of that.
Just as number is the representation of all of the women, important women that are mentioned.
Yeah. And number four, I play the role when I come in at my last scene to illustrate how much of an effect that Becca has had beyond the community. He's a person that affected more than just the people at the Jitney Station, that he takes a larger role, because you even have a line where I think it is Fielding says that he's gotten lots of people down there working at the mill. So his influence is kind of big, and you have that reference kind of like throughout the play, that how when even when Booster comes in and says, you know, you used to fill up that barber shop because everyone would stop cussing because Jim Becker has come in. That means that he has had an effect more so on the greater community than just on the Jitney Station.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, that was a great perspective on your character and how sort of the role he plays, you know, within moving the story. That was excellent. And I was wondering if you to talk a little bit about alcohol and it's you know, alcohol is a character in the play as well. And you think about sort of racism and how it affects the well-being of black people, and how do they deal with that and keep functioning, and then we have, you know, the character Fielding that you mentioned, played by Trevor, and he's a former tailor, and he just can't, he's always drinking, and it's one of the rules, I think, you can't drink. I'm not sure. Was that one of the rules on the wall, Benny?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And
he's an alcoholic, right?
Yes, he is, and Becca keeps giving him chances. In this one particular instance, he's using him as a scapegoat, because if you remember correctly, it's right after the big fight where Vernon comes in with the gun, and I can't take it out on Vernon, but I can vent on Fielding, because he's not supposed to be drinking in the station. And but alcohol does play a big role into play. Fielding continues to drink even after I fired him and took him back. So, you know, what can you do? You know, you just do the best you can do.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of grace there, you know, in Jitney. You know, the men really love each other, and I just think about, you know, Fielding. You know, he was famous. I mean, he was making clothes, designing, you know, wonderful garments for these famous musicians and artists, because he names them, and I'm like, so that's really great too, to like bring in that history, you know, so people can hear sort of what's going on. And then with the soundscape, you know, we hear all this quote race music, you know, the music that black DJs were playing but didn't necessarily have crossover, and I thought this was kind of like a real cool linkage to you know, to Motown, you know, the musical, which is currently also in San Francisco. You know, it's like, wow, you know, there's that same music.
Well, the nice thing about this play is, like, Lewis allows the cast to have input and to make suggestions and to be open for suggestions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because, you know, we had a kind of a different take on some of the music, and he allowed us to choose the music for the play, I think Dub and one of the other actors spent a day working with Lewis on choosing the music for the play. I'm sure they can talk more about it tonight, because that's something that they were involved in.
I think Stuart can speak to that one.
So we finally got the music that I really wanted. This is Lewis' character. I mean, the music we used in our preview performance was slapdash, and the music that we're using now is quite the opposite.
Yeah, Stuart, why don't you tell us about the music? Give us some titles and tell us sort of about that period of music and the black DJ and how important the DJ was. I mean, the DJ was like, sort of like he was, you know, you think about the drum, you know, in African culture sort of being how we communicate what's going on, you know, the important news. Music was like that as well at a point in our history here in America, particularly, you know, black radio and the music that they played, you know, as well as the commentary that they gave, which is what I feel listening to the music that's a part of the soundscape there, it's actually, we're supposed to be listening. I mean, it's telling us something about the events that are happening or the events that are getting ready to happen on stage.
That's exactly right, yes. That was the intent. The music was is representative of the 70s, which is where the play takes place. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because the only person that actually references the dates within the play itself is Fillmore. And it's telling you, you know, what the timing is. You get some sort of a reference, you know, by the conversation between Dub and Youngblood, and Youngblood's, you know, ascertaining that he was part of the Vietnam War and like that. But the music is the probably seventh character within the play, because even though it doesn't actually come on stage at the time the characters are speaking, it does inform of the events to come and in some of the events that have already gone to, you know, gone to pass. The intent, you know, further was, as you said, in terms of the black DJ playing, it's kind of to put the audience in the mood to see the scenes that are going to take place from that perspective. And if you notice, it's not too different from what's going on now. A lot of the music that is in the play is also being recycled, a lot of the events from the play are being recycled, fortunately and unfortunately, as the case may be.
Yeah, why don't you give us some of the titles and with regards to the recycling of events, you know, like give us some case in points.
Well, we start off with James Brown's Pay the Cost to Be the Boss, which is probably Becker's story, and because he literally does pay the cost to be the boss in this particular instance. There's a couple of Marvin Gaye tunes in there, and What's Going On, and there's Earth, Wind, and Fire's A Shining Star, which we kind of, or at least I kind of believe is the arc for Youngblood as time goes on, as, you know, again, part of the younger generation. The there are a couple of references that one of the inputs for that Lewis has had from previous there. You'll remember there's a reference to Lena Horne and Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
I forgot
between,
that part.
Dub and Turnbow. And so the lead in to that particular scene is Sarah Vaughan. What a cute, you know, a kind of a winking nod to that era as well. Because, yeah, well, as you know, all music that's gone before informs the music that's, you know, extant at the time. You know, this is. Although people were listening to 70s music in the 70s and like that, they were still listening to Sarah Vaughan, Alina Horne, and Nat King Cole, and there were, you know, other references to the folks who've gone, you know, before. So.
Yeah, yeah. And then in that, I was just thinking about, and then in that reference, you know, Alina Horne and Sarah Vaughan, you know, one could not help but go to the sort of like the skin color. You know, it's like Lena Horne, light complexion black woman, Sarah Vaughan, dark complexion black woman, and you know, and sort of, you know, sort of the politics of melanin, you know, like who do we get to see on the big screen, you know.
Yeah, I love I love Turnbull's description, as he says that Sarah Vaughan has more nature than Lena Horne. which is, you know, I think August Wilson's tongue-in-cheek way of talking about exactly that difference in melanin.
Lewis again. When you we were talking about the music, and one thing that struck me that I about music that still sticks with me, I remember them talking about the Cotton Club in Harlem in the 30s. And the black musicians who played in the Cotton Club couldn't stay in the club during the break. They had to go outside, whether it was raining or snowing or whatever. Everybody had to go, all the musicians, the dancers, all the black performers had to go outside during the break because they couldn't be seen as customers. Then after the break, they came back inside and continue to play the music. And I have to go, so just one last thing I want to put in. We, all the actors in Jimmy the Ocean and in Display, Jitney, we don't just do it as a play. To us, it's more, it's a sacred obligation. We pray, we get together, we hug to kind of pass on the spirit of what the black community has been through. And Lewis, we just don't take it as just doing another show. To us, it's a sacred obligation to go beyond and give more and give everything that we have to each performance. So. That's the only thing I was, last thing I wanted to say because I have to leave. But thank you very much for letting me speak, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for joining us. Yeah, have a good rest of the run. We were speaking just now to Benny Lewis, who plays Becker, who runs the Jitney Station. And Jitney by August Wilson, featuring all of these wonderful men on the air presently, runs through August 31st. There are two Sunday matinees, one left on the 31st. What time is the Sunday matinee?
Just the one Sunday, there's only one Sunday matinee remaining, and that's our closing.
Uh-oh.
And it's at 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock,
the last
okay.
Show.
Yeah, and then the other, you're open for performances Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8 o'clock, and then Sunday at 7. So this Sunday you have a 7 o'clock, and tonight you're on at 8, and tomorrow you're on at 8, and last night you were on at 8. And it's just really great. I want to see if I can come back because it was so fun. Yeah, it was really awesome.
You're welcome anytime.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about this play, too, is it's a crashingly strong drama, but it's also a very funny play, too. August Wilson provides a truly Shakespearean level of comic relief in the play, and I find myself comparing August Wilson to Shakespeare over and over again, especially his use of language. These are poetic dramas formed of the language of the people, and beautiful, beautiful metaphor, beautiful echoed speech, and a joy to work on. I'm not the first person that has called him the Shakespeare of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking about I have a couple of things. I wanted to ask you all if you could think about, you know, some of your favorite scenes, and then we could just go through and you could just maybe share, sort of the essence of the scene and maybe a favorite line. It doesn't have to be yours. And I was thinking about, you know, the lone female character, you know, that appears in the play. And unfortunately, she's not here to speak to her character, Robin Hughes. But sort of what that's like, you know, having, you know, this one woman, you know, sort of coming in and out physically, but then, you know, there are references to women. And then before we go there, I wanted to mention something to you, Anthony, because I was thinking about your job as a doorman. You know, that's real important, you know, the symbol of door, like that's a passage. That's the way, you know, you let people in and you close the door too, right? And their doors opening and closing all the time in this particular play. And I was thinking about, you know, in the Ifa tradition, I was thinking about Legba, and I was thinking about, you know, he sits at the crossroads, and so do you, so to speak. You know, from what you told us exactly, you know, around sort of the different ways, you know, your character opens spaces, makes references, just in case you didn't get it. You know, I was like, wow. So I was wondering if you thought about that, you know, insofar as the symbolism of the door and having access and access being taken away, which is what the play is about, right? Black people being able to have transportation, you know, throughout their city and not being able to get a cab. Like, you know, that was before the whole notion of, racial profiling, you know, like the black man standing on the corner in New York can't get a cab, and, you know, the black woman standing on the corner in Oakland can't get a cab sometimes. You know, so it's like,
Listen, I've been a black man standing in San Francisco, downtown San Francisco, and can't get a cab, so, you wave, and one just passes by, and then you wave, and another one passes by. But it is really about doors opening. I mean, I think that there's so many metaphors of the doors. It's not that physical door where people come in and come out. It's the metaphor of where you are right now, and there's always hope. I think Charles said that a little bit earlier, that there's always hope. I mean, and he goes to this speech Dub does about the opportunity is there if you want to take it. And then, you know, how with every level of a door being opened, I mean, the metaphor is for every door that closes, another window opens or something like that. But if you take a look at all the opportunities, particularly us as the black community, I mean, even more so now than back in the 70s, there's always a way for anybody to achieve their dreams. And also, I think, because you had talked about one scene that strikes me is that whole scene where Fielding and Booster are talking about dreams. About, yeah, you can't believe in your dreams. I used to dream that I used to have this bicycle, and Booster goes on about this bicycle. So dreams indoors are very, very prevalent. And I think that if you limit yourself into believing a certain mind frame, I think that's also another theme that's prevalent. You're going to still wind up with a door closed. But if you think of all your options and all your opportunities, that's how the door opens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah.
And just to piggyback on that, that's when Dove is mentoring Youngblood, and that line, he says, "If you keep thinking the world's against you, you're never going to get nothing. You just got to shake off that white man against me attitude. If you want to make something of your life, then the opportunity is there." So you have to keep pushing the door slightly open, but there's always a way to get in it. You know what I mean? It's not all the way open, but there's always, if you really push it hard, you can, the world's going to open up a little bit more, and you can, there's a chance that you can get inside that door and become the person that you want to become.
Well, that's exactly the character, what the character Sheely represents in this particular instance. Sheely's a numbers runner, and numbers back in the day were the poor man's lottery. In fact, they still exist now, but they're far and few between because lottery has gone, you know, viral, as it were. But back in the black community, that was the key to opportunity. Getting that extra, you know, $50, $100, or sometimes, you know, numbers, if you hit the number correctly, you can hit it up, you know, as far as $5,000. And that could change your life. It's an opportunity, and that's also prevalent throughout the play. Opportunities exist for pretty much, as Dub said, anything that you really want to have happen, but you have to cement in your head that you want it, number one, and B, be able to see the ways to do to proceed to achieve what you want. And in the event of Booster, yeah, Booster had a means to achieve what he wanted in the end, but that's so, you know, I kind of put him close to Icarus in that regard. You know, he flew so high that he basically burst. You know, he burst into flame and you know, went down in the fiery crash by shooting the girl. But he had achieved what he wanted to. Basically, he was on the cusp of doing so. And you know, but the fact that he's now out of prison and has an opportunity to do it again, and in fact, the end of the play does presage that. That he, in essence, takes over his father's stance. Hope I'm not giving anything away here. But that is, I think, the point of the play.
Yeah, excuse for a second. I have another follow-up for Stuart with Sheely. But also, you know, your character, Stuart, he's like a magician, and he's sort of like, I mean, there's magic, and there's, you know, because in games and chance there's magic. But then also I think about, you know, the Nkisi, you know, the magic that African people carry, because you talk about seeing, you know, you got a powerful girlfriend, you know, like you see her face. You remember, you know, how you tell us about how, you know, like she has put a spell on you. And you keep on, like, no matter what woman you're with, like, she doesn't want you, but you can't get away from her spirit. And so you see her face in all of the girls, all of the women that you like, which
exactly.
is really interesting.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and also
Rosie
how
represents,
Yeah, go ahead.
Rolly represents that opportunity as well. You know, this mm-hmm. this was Sheely is successful in a lot of ways, but he's not necessarily as successful in love as he'd like to be. And Rosie represents, you know, the opportunity lost and yet the opportunity to be found again. Because if he can replace Rosie's face with another woman, you know, he's going, this is the woman he's going to marry. So, yeah.
Yeah.
This is Anthony, real quick. And, you
yes.
know, there's also that, I have to piggyback on that just a little bit, because there's, if you notice throughout this whole play, it's always the men's relationship with the women in this play. It's referenced to quite a bit. I mean, my character has what he calls an old lady that eventually puts him out. You got the whole Youngblood and Rena relationship going there. And then Youngblood makes this reference saying that I don't want to be 22 years old and talk about I have this old gal once upon a time ago. And he's referring to Fielding's character where he says he has a wife that they hadn't seen each other for 22 years, and he had a dream about her, another mystical type of setting. And then Chile also talks about his ex-girlfriend, and then you have Becker talking about both his wife, both of his wives, but more so his first wife than his second wife, because she's always coming up, but when you have that booster Becker scene, you have that relationship, and she's referred to quite a bit in that whole scene about how she took to her bed and didn't eat for 28 days? Like that, 23 days. So there's a lot of references of relationship to women in this play that is very subtle, but is very powerful. I mean, you see it played out more with the Youngblood and Rena scenes than anything else, but it's always referenced there. It's always there that how the black woman is an integral part of the community in these men's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did anyone else want to share a favorite scene or from the play? Or did everyone do that already?
One of the scenes that I really like
mm-hmm.
is the scene where Becker is counting the young couple. I just think that seems so real, and he seems so caring, and the way he references his own experience with his current wife, and it's really neat. I also like the humor in the play. With the right audience, we get some really really big laughs. And as I said before, I really love all of the, I don't call it verse, but the poetry, the power of the poetry, the power of the metaphorical images. As far as that last scene is concerned, Booster finds hope himself, also returns hope to all the other men.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like when the men decide not to just allow the city to take over their business. They hire an attorney and they fight. Because people think, well, you know, the government has power and control. If they want something, they can have it. But these men decide to stand their ground and to not leave, because has often been the case, the government comes and boards up these buildings, and they stay boarded up for months and sometimes years, and you know those businesses could have been operating all that time. So I thought that's a nice you know, sort of change. And that's something that people can look at and do right now, because it's happening. You know, the government is taking over certain areas of certain cities and towns throughout the country. So, you know, this play gives people an option, like, oh, no, you don't have to take this. I think that's really great as well.
Yeah, that scene happens almost as if it's happening in Church and Becker, who is an important person in his own church. Becker is the leader, and the rest of the men are vocal members of the congregation. Yeah, right on. And all of that vocal response is improvised wonderfully by the cast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's been really wonderful speaking to all of you. And in closing, I just wanted to mention and maybe get some final comments, because we've been talking about sort of the currency of the work. And that's how we know that we have a classic, because, you know, no matter, you know, what year we're doing this and this, you know, it's and where it's happening, it's like it seems to always resonate, you know, with the people that are on stage as well as in the audience. And I was just thinking about how your play opened, I believe, during or around the weekend where Michael Brown, you know, 18-year-old young person, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, you know, suburb of St. Louis. And I'm like, wow, how did that tragic incident, which is still being protested and still having repercussions throughout the nation, how did that impact sort of your performance, those of you who are still in the studio?
Well, it's kind of the more things change, the more they remain the same, sort of thing, as far as I'm concerned. So, Stuart, it didn't inform, at least not to me, the performance per se, as much as it kind of floated around the periphery. I think we all know what was happening. And it made certain scenes within the performance stand out, I think. The issue with Booster and his shooting of the woman like that, which is kind of the reverse of what happened with Michael Brown, like that. But the way this occurred, the way that Booster was coerced into shooting the woman, she lied on him in a way that has been somewhat historically, this has happened on a regular basis, where, you know, white people scapegoat black folk for their own misdeeds. And this is Booster's way of saying he's not going to take that. Well, in many ways, the situation in Ferguson says, you know, we're not going to take the scapegoating of Michael Brown for, you know, the misdeed of the policeman that shot him, sort of thing. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these incidents happen. Unfortunately, they will happen again. And as they happen, they become another example of how relevant the play is.
I think that for August Wilson to have made a play that, you know, still resonates today. I mean, in this play, we're still talking about. I mean, it's been 50 years almost to since the March on Washington. Actually, probably a little bit over 50 years now, and we're still talking about race. We're still trying to get it right. In many respects, you talked about racial profiling earlier, we're still looking for black men particularly not to have to be racially profiled or just because you're walking down the street. I mean, to be assumed that you're doing something. I mean, I think of Trayvon Martin, what happened over in Ferguson. I think just automatically thought about Trayvon Brown, Trayvon Martin, mm-hmm. and how that whole thing just tied so prevalently to it, with each other, that someone's just walking down the street, and all of a sudden you just get racially profiled into thinking that you're doing something
that you may or may not have been doing. And you know, and so I think, like I think Stuart said, it wasn't necessarily affected the play in and of itself, but it did kind of it had a synergy that mixed into it that made the words that even that was designed for that time stand out in this time.
Yeah, but what the play says is, in spite of all of this, we do what we can rather than shift the blame. We persevere. We push on. We don't give up. And we do what we can. The best spokesman for that is, in the play, is Dub. That theme resonates through all of Wilson's plays. Our responsibility, every person's responsibility on earth, is to tend to their own gardens. There will be things that hurt, and there will be things that make life difficult, but those things must not be turned into excuses for inaction.
I think best said by Dr. Martin Luther King. We as a people.
Wow. Well, that's a great play. That's a great place too. I think that's a great way to end this wonderful conversation. With everyone, cast and director of August Wilson's Jitney at Multi-Ethnic Theater in association with the Custom Made Theater Company, directed and designed by Lewis Campbell at the Gulf Street Playhouse, 1620 Gulf Street near Bush in San Francisco. And for tickets and information, you can go to www.wehavemet.org, and there are all kinds of deals there, as well as information on how to get tickets for the play. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
I can offer an additional deal. Use the secret code CARSERVICE, one word, lowercase, CARSERVICE, and your ticket price will instantly drop from $35 down to $20.
Oh, that's a good deal. Wow. Okay. Cool. Say $15. Nice.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful rest of the run through Thursday through Sunday, Thursday through Sunday with one more matinee. So 8 o'clock Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 7 o'clock on Sunday, and Sunday matinee closing day on August 31st. So, really, bravo on a wonderful, wonderful performance. It's just simply fabulous seeing all these black men on stage together. It's like, oh, my goodness.
Thank you for having us.
So good. Awesome. Awesome work.
Our service at wehavemet.org.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
You
have
to see
her. All
right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Peace and
blessing. Bye-bye. So I want to let folks know about there is a Twitter town hall on race and America featuring Kevin Powell, president of BK and BK Nation, and Tim Wise, one of America's most important anti-racist writers and thinkers. And again, that's today, August 22nd, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, which would be 3 hours sooner for us. So that's 3 hours sooner, that'll be 4 o'clock. And what you do is you can do hashtag Ferguson to follow and join the conversation. So that should be really interesting. And I'm going to have this posted on wandaspicks.com, so you can look at it there. And we're going to close with a pre-recorded interview with we're going to start out with Idris Akamore and Rodessa Jones talking about Cultural Odyssey at 35. And that was a really exciting conversation. And then that particular interview show concludes with a wonderful conversation with choreographer Joanna Haygood and two of the performers, Antoine Hunter, who's been on the air quite a few times. The last time was with regards to Deaf Louder, the second annual Deaf and Hard of Hearing and Children of Deaf Parents dance festival just a couple of weeks ago. That was a really fabulous conversation and a wonderful, wonderful program. Hope you all were able to make it out to Dance Mission for that. And so we're speaking with Joanna Haygood and Travis Santel Rowland with regards to the piece, Dying While Black and Brown, which was a part of the Black Choreographers Here and Now, and then at Jaco Dance Company, performed earlier this year, April 4th through 5th. And if you remember correctly, that is the anniversary of Martin King's being killed. So again, we're going to start out with Idris Akamore and Rodessa Jones, and they're going to be joined by Lyrica, who also performed at that historic celebration of a wonderful, wonderful company. So let me look for that. And while I'm looking for that, I'm going to play, where is that piece? I was going to play something. I think I might have rolled past it. I hope not. I wanted to play Knowledge of Self, but I think I might have passed it up accidentally. So I'm going to play Charlotte O'Neill's Voices of My Ancestors, and this is for political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Hey. our comrades. Their bodies are locked down, but who are free in their minds and spirits, who fly on the wings of freedom in their dreams. And this is for Herman Wallace and all of our comrades who have made their transmission. Albert Woodfox, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Marshall Eddie Conway, Saikuo Dinga, Mutulu Shakur, Mondo Waylanga, Leonard Peltier, Ed Poindexter, Russell Schultz, Herman Vail, Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, Suniata Okome, Romaine Chip Fitzgerald, Baronza Bowers Jr., Hugo Pinnell, the Move, Africa Family, Joseph Bourne, Robert Stephay, Lynn Stewart, Abu Majid, our exiles, Pete O'Neill, Asada Shakur, free them all, free them all. Thank you.
That was Dwight Tribble. Ooh, chow. Lovely, lovely song. And I want to give you some information again about those discounts. Again, to see multi-ethnic theaters production of August Wilson's Jitney at the Gulf Street Playhouse through August 31st, you go to their website, wehavemet.org, wehavemet.org, and put in the code CARSERVICE, CARSERVICE. When you go to the play, you'll see what that means. CARSERVICE, lowercase, no space, and you get a discount, a substantial discount. Tickets, instead of being $35 to $20 opening week, you get the $20 deal. So don't want to miss that. And in the San Francisco Bay Area also is the Broadway production Motown the Musical at the Orpheum Theater through September 28th. And to get a discount on tickets there, you can call 888-746-1799 and mention the word album, A-L-B-U-M, or you can go online, shnsf.com, and put in album when buying a ticket to get a discount. I think it's like 15% off or something like that. I don't know what that means as far as the ticket price, but hey, all discounts are good. So, yeah. So now I'm going to play this show from dating from April 3rd, and the last interview for this particular segment is Dying While Black and Brown, and the first opening interview is with the founders of Cultural Odyssey, Redessa Jones and Idris Lockamore, and they're joined by Lyrica. I think Lyrica's last name is Holmes, and she is a fabulous harpist, and she performs at this 35th anniversary concert in San Francisco. So enjoy.
1 minute.
Yeah, there's something going on with this show.
Until showtime.
I didn't realize I was having technical difficulties, but don't worry, the show does start.
Pretty good, pretty good. Just shaking the cobwebs out, but I'm doing all right.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we were listening to Gina Reela's Free because I am having some crazy technical stuff this morning. I couldn't get into the studio. I couldn't play your piece that you sent me with the pyramids, which is what I want. Yeah, I played it, and then I couldn't hear it.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Oh,
it's like, what? It's like really crazy whack, and I'm like, oh, my God, it's been like 10 minutes. And I've been trying to, like, get this thing together. So hopefully, I'm glad you hung in there, and, yeah, I'm really happy that you're able to join us to talk about Cultural Odyssey and the gala, 35 years. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
35 years. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That is
really
wonderful. My goodness.
Did Redefa call in?
No, not yet. Mm-mm.
Not yet. Okay. All right.
Yeah. But she is going to be joining us.
Yeah, I think she's definitely. Are we on the air right now?
Yeah, we are. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, she's supposed to join us.
Cool. Hopefully, she hasn't run into any snags. But like I said, it's been really crazy the past this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
hopefully
you know, sometimes that's real technical. That technical stuff sometimes can really be a problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we're not always in control. Well, we're not in control of everything.
Right.
I mean, not that we ever are, but, you know. Yeah. So you're a multi-instrumentalist, composer, tap dancer, actor, director, and producer. And you're founder and executive co-artistic director of Cultural Odyssey. And you curate and produce the Cultural Odyssey Performance Festival. And also you record and tour with your acclaimed jazz ensemble, The Pyramids. Oh, my goodness. And so tell us a little bit about this weekend coming up next week. It's going to be really exciting. Tell us about, you know, sort of what it's going to be, you know, what you programmed you and Redefa for this coming weekend to celebrate 35 years.
Yes, well, you know, we're going to be doing it April 3rd, 4th, and 5th,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be at the African American Art and Culture Complex that we all know is really centrally located right here in San Francisco, and at the Burial Clay Theater, which is 762 Fulton Street. Right on the corner of Webster and Fulton, which is only about 4 or 5 blocks from San Francisco City Hall. So it's really centrally located. And it's going to be a kind of an extended program because we're going to start the evening actually at 6 p.m. Normally, you know, we usually start at 8, but this for these 3 evenings, it's going to start at 6 p.m. because we're going to be doing a sneak preview of the documentary Talk Back Out Loud. And it's a documentary that was shot, actually this Japanese filmmaker followed Redefa around and the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. Kiori followed Redefa around for about 3 years, filming her, particularly her work she does with the HIV positive women.
Mm-hmm.
And so she filmed Redefa for those 3 years, and she's basically created a documentary that's now being submitted to film festivals and has a showing right now at a theater, at a film theater in Tokyo, Japan. But we're going to show a sneak preview of it at 6 o'clock.
Oh, that's great. That's really
great.
Oh, that's going to be so
And fun. Then right after that, the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, will be performing an excerpt from their Planned Parenthood collaboration, Birthright. Medea Project is, and Cultural Odyssey is collaborating with Planned Parenthood to really address these issues regarding women's reproductive rights and the fact that it's just all over the news right now. I mean, there's such a kind of a war right now on women. From the new right and from the more conservative aspects of American society. So Redefa is going to be doing this piece with the Medea Project that's going to address all these issues. So they're going to perform from 7 to 7:30. And then there's going to be a talk back from 7:30 to about 8, addressing what the audience members were able to see and any questions that they wanted to ask. And
the audience members will also have a chance to sign up to work with the Millennium Project if they so choose. Then following that, Lyrica Holmes, who is this wonderful harpist and vocalist, we're bringing her out from Atlanta, Georgia, to really be the guest artist for all three evenings. And Lyrica Holmes, actually, the wonderful thing about Lyrica is that she's my cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's not the most wonderful. The most wonderful is she's a wonderful, talented artist, but it so happens to be that she is also my cousin, which it's wonderful to be able to introduce a family member in this way to the San Francisco audiences, because she is really quite exceptional. And she's
yes,
going to perform.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she's going to perform solo and with the members of the Healing Force, Music is a Healing Force of the Universe Community Orchestra, which is this orchestra that I've been building and actually we've been performing for the last year. And she's going to perform with vocalists such as Cheryl Scales and Marissa, Melinda Lopez, and Suze Azor. And there will also be the rhythm section of Hashima Mark Williams, Bob Marshall, and, of course, the wonderful Kenneth Nash on percussions. So she's going to perform. And then my band, The Pyramid, will also be performing, and we're going to close the show with the whole orchestra performing arrangements of some of my compositions.
Wow.
Yes,
so
it's going to be a free.
Yeah. How do people get tickets?
People can get tickets by basically calling the info line at 415-292-1850. And they can also go to Cultural Odyssey's website, which is www.culturalodyssey.org, and you can order tickets right online. And I also wanted to, you know, if you ever do this, we have definitely pairs of tickets that at some point during your program, we'd love for you, if someone calls in, that you could give away some pairs of tickets, particularly for Thursday and Friday night.
Okay. All right. Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, so folks, you hear that? You know, please give us a call at area code 347-237-4610, and you can have a pair of tickets, or you
mm-hmm.
can, you know, blog your request.
mm-hmm.
Oh, that'd be so cool. So, Idris, tell us about how. I mean, just the name Cultural Odyssey. Sounds like a process. How did you come up with the name of this ensemble, and how did you, you know, like you're from Chicago, and, you know, that's a fabulous history that you've shared with us on air. Why don't you, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, sort of your walk and this vision that you've had and how you teamed up with Rodessa, and then together, you know, now you're looking at 35 years. Of just making this beautiful art and having this, you know, the Healing Force Orchestra. I mean, like, the Healing Force. I mean, Cultural Odyssey, the Pyramids, Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, and then right now at African American Shakespeare Company, they're performing Medea.
Right.
You know, it's like, so Medea's ending this weekend, and then you know, you have your celebration next weekend. You talk about, you know, sort of this transformative vision that you've had, you know, using the arts as the key vehicle for this change.
Well, you know, I did, yes, I grew up, I'm a product of the South Side of Chicago, and I grew up, you know, I'm I'm a child of the 60s. You know, I think the 60s decade was one of the most, I think, influential decades of the whole 20th century in many ways. I'm not just saying that because that's the decade that I really remember and participated in. But, you know, the 60s was like, in terms of the civil rights struggle, in terms of so much, it was a very, very colorful decade. And, you know, I graduated from high school, actually, in one of the most important years of that decade, which is 1968. And, of course, 1968 was the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated. It was the year that Robert Kennedy was assassinated. It was also the year of the Democratic National Convention, which was in Chicago. So it was a confluence of all these elements. But, you know, even in the earlier part of the 60s, you know, I can remember, like, my mother was really very much involved in the civil rights struggle, and particularly in the struggle in Chicago that was taking place. Because when I was going to school in grammar school, Chicago public schools, black children in Chicago public schools were going to these overcrowded. We had this thing called double shift. Have you ever heard of anything called double shift?
Mm-hmm, yeah, I sure have. Mm-hmm. They're doing it again.
Double shift. The double shift in Chicago was at these overcrowded schools, black children had to go on, you know, had to go on shift to have their education, basically meaning that half of the, like from 8 to 12, one half of the school would go to school, and then from 12 to 4, the other half. So that basically meant that black children only received really half of an education. And my mother protested this. And she organized this one-day stay home for the parents, for the parents' children, so the parents would keep their kids home out of school for a day as a protest. And because of that, she was fired from her job as a teacher in the Chicago public schools. So, I mean, that was the kind of the backdrop. Episodes like that that I really remember growing up in Chicago, you know. So I had that early, you know, kind of organizational. Chicago's a very organizational town. I mean, very hardworking, and because it was so, in many ways, it could be very oppressive for black people on the South Side. In order to cope with that oppression, you really had to organize yourself to deal with it. So, you know, I'm a part of that work ethic from Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your mother was a school teacher.
Yes, she was a school teacher. For all of her, that's what she did as a living until she retired. And, you know, so she passed in the mid-90s. But she was a real educator all her life.
Yeah. So her being a school teacher, that was kind of that was not something that our community took for granted at that time, right? Having a black woman as a, you know, working in the public school system.
Well, you know, it was that she was part of that first wave of professional black women. You know, she graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. So, I mean, that was around that same time, you know, that, you know, black people were just starting to, you know, make a lot of these major steps in terms of, you know, graduates and professional teachers and things of that nature. You know, all up until that time, and, you know, during the 30s and the 40s and all that, it was, you know, that was some of the harshest times for black people trying to get, you know, jobs and the Jim Crow and all that. So, yeah, she was a little ahead of her time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So talk about, you know, sort of the arts influence. You know, was your mother also an artist? Did you have folks like that in your family? Because you are, like, sort of an all-around, you know, artist, and you actually studied that, you know, academically. So I was wondering, like, where does that come from? And then also, you know, being a product of Chicago, I mean, there's a lot of art happening there, you know, sort of art that influenced sort of direction of this country musically and also, you know, definitely impacted the world.
Yeah, well, you know, I always remember that in our living room, we always had a piano, this small spinet upright piano.
Uh-huh.
And my mother, there was no really, in my immediate family, there were no professional musicians, but my mother played piano, because she would play a little piano for her kids that she was teaching, you know, to sing certain songs and to accompany them while they were, like, singing and stuff. So she really had a little basic understanding of piano and piano playing, just on the basic, on being able to read, you know, songs and things like that. So the my parents, both my mother and father were very instrumental in having all of their kids take music lessons from a very early age. So I started studying, you know, music and taking classes and lessons from the time I was about 7 or 8 years old. So basically, I've been studying and playing music my whole life, except for, you know, maybe a period of 2 or 3 years where I kind of got really involved in playing basketball. That's what the years of high school, you know, I kind of, you know, I had like almost 5 to 7 or 8 years under my belt playing music, and then I got to high school, and I kind of just, you know, did a lot of the stuff that, you know, teenagers did at that time. I just really wanted to play basketball. I rebelled, and I really didn't want to go to music lessons. You know, I just wanted to play basketball. I wanted to, you know, that was also the time of Motown and, you know, the Marvelettes and the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the Temptations and, you know, Supremes. All that was happening, and how could you not dance and move to that music? Mm-hmm. You know, and so we were playing all these parties, so, you know, parties and going to parties and stuff. So I picked my instrument. Once I graduated, that's when I got back into my instrument again. But, you know, so I kind of consider myself to be a little bit like an artistic being. It's kind of, music is all in me, you know. It's just a part of my being. And so once that I actually got a chance to study it in college, I just furthered my musical studies at Antioch College, and I basically majored in music composition and performance, and that's where I really got my some of my main experience at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seemed like a real sort of place where a lot of innovation was taking place, Antioch.
Absolutely. Antioch was like one of your really experimental schools. They had an experimental curriculum. They, you know, first of all, they had no grades. So they had one of the schools that all you could do is get a credit or no credit, mm-hmm. you know, for classes. And, of course, you'd get a written analysis of your abilities and of what you did during the class, but they did away with the ranking, the numerical, the alphabetical ranking system. There was no A's or B's or C's or F's. The other thing that they did, there were no sports. You know, me being, of course, I had been a basketball player, but I finally got away from basketball, and there were no sports at all. There were no fraternities, and they had this program called it was cooperative education, meaning half of the time you would study at Antioch, and the other half they would place you on a co-op, which was sometimes in a whole other city. It would be in another city. It could be in D.C. or L.A. or Chicago or wherever their program had jobs for students. So I had some pretty incredible jobs as a part of my education, you know, where I would go out for a whole quarter, and I would work at a fee that was, you know, kind of a small fee, but at least you'd get paid for your work as well.
Mhm. Wow. So what kind of jobs did you have? Were they related to what you were studying?
Sometimes they were. Other times they were just to get experience and just to get work-related experience. An example is, you know, for my first co-op, I kind of wanted to go back to Chicago, actually, because I had connected with this very phenomenal, legendary saxophone instructor. His name was Clifford King. And I was studying with him, like, very regularly. And I wanted to go back and have one more quarter where I would continue to study with Clifford. So since they had a co-op in Chicago, I had this very interesting job where I was the assistant to this very famous black lawyer at that time. His name was Kermit Coleman. I'll never forget his name. And Kermit worked for the ACLU's. The ACLU had this program called the Ghetto Project. And the Ghetto Project, he was ahead, Kermit was ahead of the Ghetto Project, which was Kermit would represent any black citizen that was a victim of police brutality. And Kermit would represent him free of charge and defend him. And so I was Kermit's assistant, and my job was to discern whether this alleged police brutality was actually police brutality, or was it something that the person brought on themselves, and they were just claiming that it was police brutality. So, at the time I was there, one of Kermit's main cases was Kermit was the lawyer for Mark Clark and Fred Hampton, the Panthers that were killed by the Chicago Police Department, while they slept. They were assassinated while they slept. And Kermit was their lawyer.
Hmm.
So that was an amazing, amazing job opportunity. You know, I was able to really check out Kermit while he was doing all of this. So that was a 3-month co-op.
Wow, that's awesome. That's really awesome.
Yeah,
I think Larika is joining us now. Larika Holmes, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Oh.
Yes, it is.
Good morning, Larika. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm fine. Say hello to is that your cousin or your niece?
Yes, my cousin,
Izzy. Yes. Hey, Larika, how are you
doing? I've been listening to you. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm going to call Regessa while y'all talk a little bit and make sure to see if I can get her on the line. Okay,
oh,
well,
that'd be super. Okay, sounds
okay.
Good.
Go ahead.
That sounds good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Woo.
So, Larika, it's so exciting that you're visiting us. Is this your first time coming out to San Francisco to perform professionally?
Yes, it's my first time to San Francisco performing, and I've always been trying to get to San Francisco, but I just hadn't had the opportunity, and I'm just so excited to be able to be there. I know that's one of the locations we were thinking of moving at one point in time, and still maybe considering moving out there. So.
Oh my! Wow. Yeah. When I realized that you play the harp, it's like wow, two harpists. I mean, Destiny Muhammad is
love
know,
Destiny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. This is really great. Tell our audience a little bit about you. It's the internationally performing artist Larika Holmes, African American recording artist, singer, harpist, songwriter, and teacher. She was born and raised by her parents in St. Louis, Missouri, and she started playing the piano at an age of five. And it was really funny. Mm-hmm. Idris was saying that he started playing piano at 7.
Yeah.
Must be something about your family, you know, getting you all, you know, sort of musically indoctrinated when you're really young.
Definitely. They got us started really early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in junior high school, your parents encouraged you to step out of the box and play something different. And that's when you switched to harp. And since then, I mean, the way you play the harp is so accessible. I mean, you got rap and harp happening in the same musical composition. It's like, wow. It's like, and you're singing love songs. I mean, it's real contemporary R&B. And then it's like, that's a harpist playing there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. A lot of people, when they look, they expect, when they see harp, and they're like, oh, Larika, okay, well, you're going to, they expect me to come out and play, you know, Pachelbel's Canon D, or they're expecting, you know, some other classical piece, or, you know, or they say, oh, you know, they always immediately compare me to Jeff Majors. And, you know, and then when I come out and I end up doing, you know, contemporary pieces or even electronic dance music or something like that, they say, oh, we didn't know the harp could do that. So it's exciting.
Yeah. You know, you're classically trained, so you do know those other pieces. You have
definitely
a bachelor's in music education
from
the University of, is it University of Memphis at St. Louis? Is that what that means?
No, U of M, my undergrad I got from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And then my master's came from University of Memphis.
Right. Yeah. And you Let's see, you've done quite a few different things. You've performed for numerous events and occasions around the world, including your recent excursion to Shanghai, China. You'll tell us about that.
Mm-hmm.
And you shared the stage with many artists such as Aretha Franklin, oh my goodness,
mm-hmm.
Howard Hewitt, Paul and Michelle, to name a few.
Mm-hmm.
You can drop some other names you like. and recently R&B artists Joe, Lara, Isabor, mm-hmm. Phil Perry,
yeah.
Miles J,
mm-hmm.
and Carrie Hilson. I don't know any of them. You have to tell me who they are.
Oh, that's okay.
And you teach online in a
I do.
That sounds really interesting. So tell us a little bit more about yourself. You can start with the dropping names if you like. You can tell us about, you know, recorded music, you know, any
mm-hmm.
recent projects. You mentioned you sent me some music, and one of them is a new piece.
Yeah,
and we're definitely
going
to play that. Yeah, so tell us something about yourself and what you plan on bringing to San Francisco next week.
Okay, well, I hate to, like, it's a name drop. You know, I'll name a couple of people, you know, every once in a while. But, you know, we try to keep it a surprise until the projects come out. But I know with the piece that you're going to play, Blackbird Reloaded, we recorded that one here with Jimmy LaFavor, who's a member of GMIA, which is the Georgia Music Industry Association. So we've been working closely with them as far as getting the piece created. It features rap artist Rick Flow. Awesome. He's coined the beat snatcher. So, and you'll be able to hear it when you hear him in the song. But that's one of the pieces that's getting ready to drop. I would say in May we're working on the video at this point. So we want to kind of, you know, put them out as close together as possible. But I would say as far as what I'm bringing to the Bay is a little mix. I'm kind of out of the box with what styles I perform. I love R&B. I love electronic dance music. I do some pop. Jazz is in me because it comes from my family and everybody on my father's side. So I always try to incorporate jazz and as well as classical. So a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you know, and I'm just excited to be able to share it out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how was it, you know, picking up the harp? You know, piano is a string instrument as well, you know, as well as percussive.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like, I'm sure, a huge shift, but they look differently. And you can't carry the piano with you. You can carry your harp. I mean, you know, it's big, but, you know,
right.
You can carry it. And so I wanted you to talk a little bit about just the harp. I mean, because angels play the harp, right? And your name is Lyrica. Your parents named you this name that's, like, so musical. I mean, you seem like you were sort of destined to be an artist.
Well, I tell you this. My parents, they gave me the birth name of Erica. And then when I got more into music and as far as writing my own songs, and I got to the point where I was playing the harp and singing and doing things like that, my parents were very instrumental with my producer, and they worked together to create my name, Lyrica Holmes. And since that time, I've taken that on, and I've kept that since then. But I played the piano for a while, and then I went to double bass, string double, you know, the upright bass. And my teacher ended up being out for a while. And so my parents said, like, well, you're going to continue doing something. You know, we're going to choose something for you. And so they chose harp. So I was like, no, in the beginning, because, you know, I was the only one who was, you know, I had to carry it on the bus. And, you know, the students were mad because I was blocking all of the, you know, blocking the pathways to the back of the bus. And, you know, just it was so hectic growing up with it. But, you know, I'm just fortunate that my parents were smart enough and they already knew what I needed to be doing and that I had very influential and supportive teachers who trained me and continued to stay with me, you know, even throughout my college career, because my high school last harp teacher, which was Maria Pinkney, they took her from the high school and hired her at my university so that she can continue teaching me even when I was working on my degrees.
Wow, that's so supportive. So they hired a teacher for you. Well, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Wow, what a great education. educational system. Does that still
yes,
exist,
I like it.
That they would do that?
I don't know.
Hey, let me jump in right here, Wanda.
Yeah.
Wanda, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I just jump in because, you know, one of the things that it was very interesting because, you know, my part of my, talking about growing up in Chicago, well, mm-hmm. Chicago and St. Louis is a little bit like San Francisco and Los Angeles. It's almost about the same amount of time to go to drive from Chicago to St. Louis, the same time to go from San Francisco to L.A. So a lot of my summers, that's where my parents, we that's where we would go for summer vacation. My mother was off teaching, she was off from teaching school, and my father would take his 1 or 2 weeks from the post office. And we would drive that about 5 hours down to St. Louis, and we would definitely go to my great aunt, to her house, and her daughter was my aunt Marcella. And so that was the house. They had this huge house. I'll never forget. It was on mm-hmm. Bartner Avenue. And it was like 3 or 4. I remember it was a humongous kind of house. But they also had a piano downstairs in the living room. And Marty, we call him Marty, Marty's mm-hmm. Sons were Billy Ball, Kenny Ball, mm-hmm. and Almeda. Was a daughter, and Kenny. When I would go down there, Kenny, I'd be going down. I was maybe 16 or 15, and Kenny was like 16 or 17, and I guess Billy was a couple of years older than Kenny. Was he was about a couple of years older, Lyrica?
Yeah, just a couple.
And mm-hmm. so, and then what I didn't realize was that what I found when I got down there is that Kenny had the most hot R&B band in St. Louis. I mean, he had this band that was like just all I remember is that it was hot. I mean, he was like 16, 15 or 16, and he was playing alto saxophone. So they had the hottest jumping band in St. Louis, playing for a lot of dance concerts and all that. So that's what I remember when I would go down to my cousin's house, and then Kenny would show me a couple of things on the saxophone, and I'll never forget he actually taught me how to play Spooky, which is this kind of a classic song that saxophone players were playing. And but I would tag along with him, and I'd go around to some of the bands of some of the shows the band would do. And that was just such an amazing time for me, remembering a lot of that. And even to this day, Kenny is now a piano tuner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he plays drums, and he still plays some saxophone. So Kenny is still very much involved living in St. Louis. I think he lives on that same block, doesn't he, Lyrica?
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. He's living in that same house too.
Wow.
The musical house.
I think this might be Rodessa. Let me see. Good morning, Rodessa. Hey,
yes,
Rodessa.
Good morning. Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm
so
fine.
Lyrica and Idris, say hi to Rodessa.
Hey, Rodessa.
Hello.
How are you? Hey, Lyrica. It's hello. Nice to have you aboard for this adventure. How are you, Lyrica?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm here in Wisconsin. The sky is kind of gray, but there isn't any more snow. So, they say it's going to be a warm weekend, but yes, mm-hmm. I'm here, but I'm looking forward to coming home, flying in Wednesday for a big gala, and I know it's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah,
Rodessa, congratulations on the movie. So, Rodessa Jones is a co-artistic director of Cultural Odyssey and founder and director of Medea Project Theater for Incarcerated Women, and now
mm-hmm.
she travels around the world, and she has a residency where she's calling us from, where it's cold. And you tour and speak to Theater for the 21st Century Art, which participates community transformation. I wonder if you could talk a little bit, Rodessa, about this 35th anniversary festival. Congratulations.
Well, you know, it's always time is the dictator. And, you know, I look up and I go, oh, my God, it's been 35 years. And, you know, Egis and I have just been so fortunate to just still be in the game, being influential. And even though I looked up and time had passed, I thought, wow. And I know that Egis will be holding it down until I get home. My God, I met Egis. What was it, Egis? 1982, was it?
79.
79, and you know, and I always tell people that my father had just died, and I feel like he sent Egis to me. It was like, was his way of like sort of giving me guidance, because my father was my favorite guy. And as I'm listening, I was listening to you all talk about Kenny and St. Louis, and I just realized that how my dad and you know, the veil, you know, the door to eternity swings both ways, and I feel like my father really set this thing up cosmically. So each sophomore and I would be here 35 years later celebrating all of the adventures that we've had and all the things that we have been able to witness together as artists, and also to be so influential going on, in particular with the African-American community, but in general with arts in America. I'm very proud to stand next to him, and you know, and then the film coming out of Japan, a Japanese filmmaker, finding her way to working with the Medea Project and Cultural Odyssey to continually document our efforts and our explorations. Looking at art for everybody, you know, one of my questions always is like, who do we make art for? And Egis and I have been really graced and blessed and lauded for we've been very brave, you know. He and I have done all kinds of things, the two of us, you know. I mean, as we're talking, I'm thinking about our first trip to Europe, when the two of us just kind of rocked Germany. We were in Austria, and with this duet that people were trying to figure out, well, who are these crazy Americans? And we were like, we're performance music, you know, which meant that we did storytelling, we did music, we did, of course, a lot of political theater, and set this precedent in a lot of ways for a new way of blacks performing in Europe, you know, telling our story, celebrating jazz and jazz history, and also coupling, you know, just being one of those couples Max Roach and Abby Lincoln, like Ella Fitzgerald and Chick Webb, you know, we were all that. As a musician here in Wisconsin who is so excited about our 35th anniversary, and he was saying to me the other evening, he was saying, oh, you guys really did it. You just hung in there. And now it's like, this is what you did with your lives, which is, I'm so grateful. And I'm looking forward to what the Medea Project will do, this celebration, having Lyrica, you know, here in San Francisco doing her work and performing with us. And of course, Egis is, Healing Force Orchestra, you know, so it's going to be a great time. And, you know, I'm going to fly in for this, and I have to fly back here to finish this residency with my students here, so I'm rolling.
Wow.
I'll fly out in May to join Redessa when they they're going to do a culminating concert, a culminating performance of Redessa's residency, and I'll fly out and I'll do the music and work with the students as well. But I wanted to also see how, you know, a lot of times this is like, it's a 360 degrees, how everything kind of connects. And speaking about Lyrica and St. Louis, it was funny because Redessa was actually at the home on Bartner Avenue because we were on our way to Chicago. This was, I think, in about 80, no, this was early, mid,
was
about
early,
mid
early
90s.
80.
No, it was mid 90s. This was the 90s.
Okay.
Anyway, we were driving and to Chicago, but we stopped off in St. Louis at the Bartmer House on Bartmer, and my aunt Wee Wee told me told me this story about basically my great-great-grandmother, Grandma Cole. And she told Redessa the story that we were there, she must have been like 90s in or something. I don't know exactly
how
old.
Yeah, she was fantastic, fantastic mind and historian for the family, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I noticed. Tell her the story.
Well, she told me about an ancestor, an elder, Grandma Cole, who was, I think, the great-great-great-great-grandmother in Idris's family, and about her crossing over from Africa. And, you know, what's so rich about this story is that in all of our families, there is this lore that we have that we should pass on. And this is, and I was privy to being outside, walking around the backyard with Cousin Wee Wee, and she was telling me, she was relaying the story to me. Here we are, like 400 years later or something, and she's telling me about how Grandma Cole had come over as a little girl on this ship from Africa and had become mesmerized by all these guinea hens that were encased on the ship, and she let the Cole release them, and the birds flew off, and she suffered incredibly at the hands of the slavers and the sailors, and but the other side is that there's a magnificent family, you know, Idris's family has survived to this day, and that was like a part of the journey, and it was a woman's story, and I was so moved that I was able to hear it from this amazingly powerful ancient woman. I mean, when she spoke, it was like a stone speaking, and at the same time, it was her voice was so measured, and it was like it took me back there. So I don't know how much longer after that, Idris, that I actually wrote it down, and it's become a part of Cultural Odyssey's greatest hits. It's the Grandma Cole story, and Wanda, if you saw she, it was how I began. Yeah, that is from their family archives. That story, that is a true story, you know, of our deliverance. You know, we as African Americans, here was another piece of history to share with our children, and which brings us all the way back to Lyrica being with us. And And if you look at the bakers Idris's family, which I know fairly well, I love it that they all have these big, wide, clear eyes, you know. And then they're musicians, you know. They're musicians, which is so magical, because it is. I just fell in love all over again with Nikki Giovanni, and she talks about how musicians are the ones that we want to hang out with. Musicians are the ones that tell the story in such a clear and crystal way that it can do nothing more than open our hearts. And so coming to San Francisco for the 35th anniversary is a heart opening for me, and I hope for all of our fans and our friends and our family who has been there to support us and to follow us. So I'm looking forward to having a good old time, and there's going to be great food, as always, because Cultural Odyssey throws down. Saturday night will be a gala with Peasant Chic. The food will be a lot, and it'll be rich and delicious. we're gonna rock and roll to the broad daylight.
Yeah.
Yes. Wow! How awesome! I have another question for you, Rodessa, and then Derek, I want you to tell us about China. Rodessa, so tell us what you're doing there, because Idris mentioned that he's going to be flying out to Wisconsin for a closing, performance. So I was wondering, are you doing theater right now with the students, and then they do a performance at the end?
Yeah, we're building a work together. I created a class entitled Forward Motion, Narratives for the 21st Century. And it's really about getting young people to share with me what are they talking about, what are their concerns. These are the people that are going to be, you know, taking care of us, you know, in another 20, 30 years. They will be making decisions. They will be the ones who will be passing the laws. And I'm curious as to what they see as important. And so we're examining something called food deserts. And food deserts are simply like, for example, Detroit. And Detroit doesn't have a lot of farmers markets. You know, the city itself is, like, literally closing down, so we're led to believe. And how do the inhabitants of that community, those communities, get fresh food, which means a lot of the African Americans not having access to fresh vegetables and this kind of thing. And the students brought this to me. Another one is love deserts, talking about transgender people. I mean, and these young people care about, you know, the transgender community, being women who are now men or in the transitioning into being men, or men who are transitioning to being women, and the identification with the female species. I mean, it just kind of blew my hair back what they were interested in, and at the same time they did not have a lot of information about the war, about the war against women globally. You know, sex trafficking. So we trade information. There's a lot of slam poetry. We're moving now. I just introduced them to Bob Kaufman. They didn't know who Bob Kaufman was. So we've been doing one of his poems, An Unholy Mission. But it will be an event that will culminate into a show where Idris will come in, as he does in South Africa, where as a co-director and as musician, he'll add rhythm and movement to our words and to the movement. And the piece will look like, I think, I'm hoping that it will look like a live museum exhibition. There'll be a series of tableaus and tables, and we'll look at food. Because, you know, the food industry on the college campuses, I wasn't aware of how restricted it is as to, you know, it's all contracted out to other companies. It isn't like young people can eat as much as they want anymore and take food back to their rooms. You have a certain kind of food card, and you have to eat, you know, if they're serving chicken, you can't have one piece. You have to at least have two. So the students are worried about waste. And you know, here in California, we talk about food, not bombs. But in Wisconsin, there are places where you cannot take food that has not been eaten and share it with the poor. So these are their concerns. So these are the new narratives of the 21st century. And out of this, I have been writing, and we just read Toni Morrison's Playing in the Dark, Cornel West's Race Matters. And there's a new book called Black Woman Solo, which they're reading right now, to look at performance from a political perspective, to look at the minds of black women performers, because that's who I am, really. I'm an artist who's an activist, who is a performer, who's an autobiographical performer. And so it's rich. It's very rich. And I'll be really curious as to what the script will look like. And everybody's very excited about Idris coming in May and putting the kibosh on it with the music. Yeah.
Wow, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, this is the University of Wisconsin in Madison, yeah. And I've been here for the semester, so I braved the winter.
You've conquered the winter.
Yeah.
Wow. So, Lyrica?
Yes?
Yeah,
yes,
why don't you
yes.
tell us about, you know, sort of about your travels, because it sounds like, you know, you're sort of the tradition, and you are keeping the tradition, and you are, you know, one of those young people that Rodessa was speaking of with regards, you know, to, you know, you're the ones that are going to be setting policy and,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to make lemonade out of, you know, some of the mess that, you know, the elders are,
yeah.
are causing, you know, right now. It's like, oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Well, yes. I'm just fortunate to have a strong foundation to stand on. I have great role models, and Idris, my cousin, and I have several other people who are out there, cousins who are out performing. And I know when I was over in China, I was there with another one of my family members. Her name is Paula Michelle, and she's an amazing singer, performer. And she told them about me, and so they said, oh, well, have her come over. So I ended up going to Shanghai and Hong Kong,
wow.
I would say a little over a month and a half, performing at the Brown Sugar Bar.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, brown
yes,
sugar
brown
bar.
Sugar. Yes.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. But it was a really nice establishment. We performed, I would say, 3 shows a night, 6 nights a week. And
wow.
It was just amazing, the amount of people who were coming in. It was so many people who were coming in from different countries. And it was like their stopover place was to come to the Brown Sugar Bar. Well, Brown Sugar Live. And so, it was a great experience. It was very, very crowded in Shanghai, I'd say that. It's a culture and you would have to get used to it to live there or be longer than that amount of time. So I was thankful to be there the time that I had, and I was happy when I made it back home. But I did
always
have a lot of fun. Yes, I had a lot of fun when I was there, and they really catered, and make sure that you're well taken care of over there. And so it was a lot of fun, and I would definitely go back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So have you all been in China, Idris and Redessa? Have your travels taken you there as a company?
No, I traveled to Hong Kong and Guilin, China, many years ago with a friend. In fact, we hooked up with the Urban Bush Women. But
nice.
Cultural Odyssey has not been to. Have we? We've been to so many places.
No, not to China yet. We haven't really the Asian part of. Of course, we've done a lot of things, and we've done things in Japan, but not to China.
Yeah, I want to go to Japan. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
wow.
Japan.
Wow.
Yeah, Japan was great. The time we had such an amazing experience in Japan because that was around me and Redessa. When me and Redessa went to Japan, of course, I've been to Japan otherwise, and she's been solo as well to Japan, and I've been solo to Japan. But when we went together, that was right around the time we were doing our Ike and Tina Turner 2-person musical. Speaking of St. Louis, but we did Ike and Tina Turner. We had this very popular show called I Think It's Going to Work Out Fine. And this guy decides that this American businessman who lived in Japan, decided that he saw our show, and he decided he wanted to bring the show over as an experiment to, he worked with a computer firm, so he was going to translate our entire script into Japanese hiragana, the symbol, the Japanese language, and they were going to translate our script, and then they were going to take us to this huge convention center. We were going to perform, and they were going to have these subtitles on a screen with a movie being played during our performance. We were being filmed and translated while we were doing it into Japanese on the screen.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And the computer company was NEC. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, we had huge images of us as well as we were on stage, and that was really one very funny part where Idris's character, who was based on Ike Turner, was supposedly doing cocaine, I guess. And the Japanese didn't know what it was, so they had to write in hiragana, "He is now taking drugs." that was a lot of fun. It was like
it was so crazy. And just a little backstory: we arrive into the Japanese airport, right? And we've got all our costumes and instruments for the stage. We arrive, and I had a bag, a little costume, like a little costume bag. It was a little
prop
like
bag,
a prop bag. And, because the thing that I used to show that he was doing cocaine was like this little, it was like little powder that was I think it was baby powder or something like that.
No.
Yeah. And so they went inside my little prop bag, and the custom guy thought that he had caught some drug smugglers.
Yes.
The guy says, he took me and Redessa in this little room. And they were getting ready they were reading us the Riot Act. No, you can't bring drugs into Japan, and now you're going to be sorry for this and all kinds of stuff. And so we were trying to tell them, no, this is just props. This is kabuki.
Safety.
Wow.
And so then he brought his boss in, and they finally realized that it was not real cocaine.
Well, they took it. Well, while he was dressing us down, they took it off, and I think they tested it. And they realized that it was a long way from cocaine. Yeah, it was, you know, but that was pretty scary. But now you look back, it was funny. But then it was like, oh my God!
Right, it was scary back, but that was a cautionary tale. I mean, that colored my travel from then on.
Yes.
Well, we're running a little bit over. I've got other guests in the studio. But
okay.
I really appreciate this wonderful conversation. I don't think I've had you all on together, you know,
no.
That I can think of. And this is just so fun having you all walk down memory lane with us and on the air. And I want to let our audience know that Idris did offer a couple of pairs of tickets for the Wednesday, Thursday shows?
No, Thursday and Friday shows.
Thursday and Friday show, which is the 3rd and 4th. Yeah, so that offer still stands, even though I haven't gotten any calls. So you just have to, you know, send me a blog or Facebook or something. Let me know that you're interested, you know, with your name and your phone number so we can get back to you about the tickets. So do we have one pair or two pairs? How is it working, Andrew?
There can be two pairs for Thursday and two pairs for Friday.
Oh, you are so kind. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are you coming to the gala?
The Saturday night.
Yeah,
I'm going to try to. I was going to definitely come like earlier, like, you know, the Thursday. But I'll try to come back because I know the parties are really fun.
That'd be fun, yeah.
Yeah. But it's going to really be awesome. Looking forward to seeing you, Lyrica. And so I'm going to play the music at the end of the show since I'm running into the next interview. So I'm going to play the Pyramids mix, Idris, and Lyrica, I'll play your Blackbird Reloaded.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'll also play them next week as well, you know, leading up to the performance beginning Thursday. I'll play something on Wednesday.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Wanda. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Wanda.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, safe travels, Lyrica and Rodessa. We're looking forward to seeing you. And, we're having some pretty good weather. Lots of rain, which is wonderful. And then we have these warm. Yeah, we sure
do. Sun is out today. Sun is out today, so that's good.
Yeah, the sun is out. And we'll have the sun come out, you know, for you all when you come in, and then maybe some more rain later.
I'm gonna have to go get my toes did. If the sun's shining, I can wear sandals.
All right, cool.
All right,
you all take care. Thank you.
Okay, bye bye. See you, Lyrica. See you, Rodessa.
Peace and blessings.
Okay,
all right.
I'll talk to you again soon. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye
bye.
Bye. Good morning. how are you doing? Is this Joanna?
Travis.
Hey, Travis. How are you?
Hey, I'm here. I'm sorry. I was on mute enjoying the show. I was like, what? It's a dream of Odessa. How can I not jump in?
That was
almost cruel.
Yeah, well, you all have collaborated, you know, on that
know.
Wonderful
team. I know. I adored them. They're so wonderful, and I'm really excited about their new show.
Yeah. So we have the three of you all in the studio. So we've got Travis, Joanna, and who's the third person?
I think it may have been Maddie or Rashad.
Yeah, they're not speaking.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, now I can. Yeah, who's that?
No, it's just Antoine Hunter.
Oh, it's Antoine.
Oh, Antoine, say something else because you're real far away. Say it. Say something else.
Okay, I'm trying. My microphone. Okay, all right. Can you hear me clearly now?
Yeah. And then someone else just joined us. Good morning. Who's the fourth person that just joined us?
This is Sandra Hooper, Mayfield. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Sandra. Oh, you're listening?
that I was interested in those tickets.
Oh, okay. All right. All right, send me an email, and you can help here. Because we're in another interview right now.
Okay, all right.
Oh, super. Well, that's great. I'm glad you got the tickets. Congratulations. Oh, that's nice. Okay, cool. All righty. So, so, Joanna, tell us about Dying While Black and Brown, and then I'll read your bios after that. Wonderful, wonderful piece that you premiered, in the East Bay for the Black Choreographers Festival Here and Now. It's really, really powerful. So powerful, I saw it twice. We had to come back because in both times I saw something different. Tell us about the commission from the Equal Justice Society and, you know, the original music that Mark Shelby Orchestra created around the piece. And, it's just really wonderful, wonderful work that really brought to our attention what's happening with, you know, our brothers, black and brown men specifically that are literally dying, you know, in these prisons here in California and elsewhere in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, the piece was, as you said, it was commissioned by the Equal Justice Society, and they are a civil rights law firm based in Oakland and run by an extraordinary woman and force of nature, Eva Patterson. And Eva has long been interested in finding new ways of disseminating information, getting people clear and inspired to and motivated to work towards change. And one of her methods is incorporating art and commissioning artwork that helps tell, you know, these very important stories. So she's worked with Marcus Shelby for, I think, maybe 10 years. Quite a long time, but it had a very, you know, a really fruitful, you know, collaboration. And about the Monkey and the Devil was, but somebody from EJS came to our show, The Monkey and the Devil at Yerba Buena, and brought it to the attention of Eva. And one thing led to the next, and she said, I really want to bring you and Marcus together. And I, of course, you know, been an admirer of Marcus Shelby's work, but I'd never met him and had never obviously worked with him. So they were working on a campaign to bring attention to death penalty issues and were organizing a conference around these issues and featuring at the time, a recent exoneree, Anthony Graves, who was in Texas, on Texas death row for 12 years of his 18 years in prison. So, she brought us together with Anthony. We had a long, extensive interview with him. She brought in Jeannie Woodford, who had been the warden at San Quentin for a number of years and who had overseen, I believe, 4 executions. Natasha Minsker, who's been working on death penalty issues for many, many years, who's at the ACLU. And Andy Love, who was an attorney. So she, you know, the one thing about Eva is that she's able to access these incredible people and resources to actually inform the work in a way that is really substantive and you know, really, really powerful. So the piece premiered a few years ago, I think December 2011 at Yoshi's as part of this conference. And Anthony was there, which was really, really wonderful and gave us tremendous feedback and actually so much of what his interview. So we've been, I personally have been very interested in continuing this work because I do think that this issue really needs as much attention as it can get. It's not that we have completely forgotten, but we are detached as a country to, you know, this issue and these stories of, you know, real life people on death row, and particularly this disproportionate number of people of color. You know, black inmates make up 41, almost 42% of the death row population. It's, you know, it's completely out of balance. 80% of, you know, the victims are white. You know, so there's obviously a, you know, race issues that come into sentencing and an extraordinary disparity and inequity and how all of that takes place. So we've been, you know, speaking with other lawyers and law schools and trying to find ways to collaborate and to bring their efforts or to support their efforts, really, by our performance of this piece. So that's where we are today, and we've been basically, I mean, you know, in any artwork, there's always room for clarification and articulation of the actual form and information. More information keeps coming to us, which really does shift the way that we're interpreting things. So we're really kind of working on developing the piece and honing it right now, and that's why we've been performing it. We've performed it 3 times over the last 6 months, I think. Yes, we worked with San Francisco State and their Department of Performing Arts and Social Justice, and again at Black Choreographers, as you mentioned, and now we're doing it at our studio. And we're very excited about that because we're going to be joined by a fantastic panel of people who are working on these issues. And so really, really good and very, very strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's Friday, April 4th at 8 p.m. The post-performance discussion is with Michael Lawrence, Anna Zamora, and James Bell. You can tell us who they are. And then on Saturday, there's another performance of Dying While Black and Brown, April 5th, 2014 at 2 p.m. And both performances and the panel are free. And they're going to be at the Zocco Studio, which is at 1777 Yosemite Avenue, number 330 in San Francisco. And the phone number there is 415-822-6744, or you can go online to Zacho, ZACCHO.org. So, Joanna, who are the post-performance panelists that are going to be?
Okay, well, the panel's going to be moderated by Michael Lawrence, and he's the Executive Director of the Habeas Corpus Resource Center, which is a California Judicial Branch agency that provides representation to death row inmates in the state and federal habeas corpus proceedings or habeas proceedings. And Anna Zamora is a senior policy advocate for the American ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. And she was also the former program director at Death Penalty Focus, which is an organization that Jeanne Woodford founded, the San Quentin warden, or former San Quentin warden. And James Bell, who's the founder and executive director of the Burns Institute, which is a nonprofit that works with in the field of juvenile justice and the reduction of racial disparity. So they are an incredibly accomplished group. They're really informed. They're active in trying to make change in policies and particularly around race relations. And, you know, racial disparity. And, yeah, so I think that anyone who is interested in this topic, this would be a great opportunity to take and to learn from this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we should all be interested in this
yes,
topic.
That's right. We should all be interested. Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Well put.
Right, yeah. Well, you have a wonderful cast of men who are dancing in this really hard piece, and two of whom are on the air with us. Antoine Hunter has been a guest on the show many times. He's an African-American deaf and hard of hearing, choreographer, dancer, dance instructor, model, actor, and poet. Antoine Hunter was born deaf and was raised in Oakland, California, and began dancing with Don James at Skyline High School. He studied West African dance with Master CK and Betty Lezekpo, and studied at the Paul Taylor Summer Intensives in 2003 and 2004 as a full scholarship student. And he's also performed with Savage Jazz Dance Company as a dance artist, performer, jazz instructor. He's performed with Nuba Dance Company, Sins Invalid, Sonic Dance Theater of Epiphany Productions, Lorraine Hansberry Theater, Elio Dance Company, which has their gala coming up beginning of April, a Cat Willis Push Dance Company, which has something this weekend at MOAD, and Robert Moses Ken Dance Company, Sign Dance Collective, a.k.a. Oh, Antoine is just so famous, like everyone else who's on the air today. And then we've got Travis. Travis, are you still with us?
I am. I'm here.
Okay, Travis Santel Roland, whom I've enjoyed watching you at San Francisco State and performance there in the wonderful sort of salute and tribute to Dr. Alberta.
Rose.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was so wonderful. And I've seen you with Push Dance Company at MOAD,
okay.
And also I've seen you dancing with Joanna's company multiple times. The last
yes.
one, besides dancing while Dying While Black and Brown, is when you all were at the Oakland Museum at the Equal Justice Society looking at
people.
The. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, that was so
okay.
awesome. Oh, my goodness, that was
great. It was crazy. A lot of fun to do, too.
Yeah, yeah. So Travis is an American interdisciplinary performing artist who holds a BA degree in both drama, popular theater, and dance, performance, and choreography from San Francisco State University, where he served as student artistic director for the University Dance Theater in 2005 and 2006. And was honored by the School of Music and Dance with the Award of Outstanding Student in Performance. His solo performance and choreography of Residual Sugar, 2006, was featured in the American College Dance Festival Association's Southwest Regional Conference Gala Awards concert in January 2007. He began training in hip-hop dance, went on to study modern and contemporary forms, and is currently hired for projects under T-R, and then capital A-V, is M-O, and then capital V-E, lowercase E-S, Travis Moves. I like that you
yes.
have to see this on paper to be able to really appreciate it.
It's moving on paper at you also. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you've danced a whole lot of places, and if you have a website, we could send people there. Do you have a website?
I don't have a website. I just I use Facebook for that, so they can just put like / Travis Moves or look
mm-hmm.
me up by my name, and I use that just more as advertisement for the arts and things like that.
Okay, yeah, yeah, because your bio is really really impressive, but I want you to start talking about your character in this piece. So yeah,
absolutely.
I want to jump to that. Mm-hmm.
Well, to go ahead and get started, it was really nice to drop into all this really serious, purposeful subject matter a few years ago, back in 2011. Of this current cast of the four of us, I'm the only one who was in it in the original rendering of it when we performed it at Yoshi's with Marcia Shelby's Orchestra Live. And we talked about a lot of, you know, really serious things. We focused a lot on the conditions in prison and a lot of the isolation, somehow trying to, like, navigate your way through the everyday structured rigmarole of the mundane and how you can reach, well, we pretty much have to reach a piece of that, otherwise, you know, you won't survive. And also how to somehow keep your hopes up or keep some sort of incentive to keep going, because especially for people on death row with these life and or life sentences, there's really no end to it, and so you have to wake up in the morning and try to figure out how you're going to get through.
So how do you sort of, I mean, because maybe you could describe the set for our audience that hasn't seen it yet, because it's quite physical theater dance performance, and you know, as you are embodying this character, you're also like physically moving around a whole lot. I mean, you even have altercations, like, and I think you win.
Yeah. That's under debate. Joanna and Matthew and I always, you know, argue about that in the form of a joke. But yeah, there's a lot of, I guess you can call it technically, you know, stage combat in there. There's a fight scene that breaks out in the yard with between Matthew's character and mine. It starts out vocal and then it turns physical. The set is a huge steel-framed house that Wayne Campbell had built, and it's painted orange, which is really fitting for the whole, you know, orange jumpsuit attire in prison. And it's a steel-framed house. It's kind of, you know, kind of goes up at like a peak, like a roof. It has two kind of window frames in it. It's one piece. It kind of disconnects, and we're able to move it around and take it place to place by dividing it in half, but it actually is just in one physical piece when we're working with it. we're all crammed in it. We use it as like a prison yard. So the perimeter of it, the border of it, represents different things. And we'll have someone in it, and then two people on each side representing adjacent prison cells. It's just big enough to be able to put all of our individually our arms span out, and we can touch pretty much like the windows on each side, so it kind of shows the claustrophobic, really confined nature of what it's like in prison. Our gargoyles at one point were hurling ourselves, you know, off of it and like falling into it, like showing like being thrown into this situation. You know, we're looking upward and optimistically trying to, like, you know, make our way out of it. We tip it sideways. We put it up on a corner and pirouette it around, all sorts of fun stuff physically to do, but it actually is really applicable with how acrobatic and how physical this form of dance theater is to tell the story. And Marcus Shelby's music is really, really driving it, and it sets up a whole, for me, just, I don't know how to articulate it in the form of like music, but it sets up this unrest that is really driving. And as a performer up there with these three other extremely physically capable and able dancer, athlete, men, storytellers through, you know, physical theater and whatnot, complements and helps just like, you know, me having as a performer drop in and be able to kind of match the intensity of the music and also the subject matter. And tell the story of lots of these folks, and you know, Anthony Graves, and what it's like to have gone through all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Had you ever contemplated the subject matter before this piece? Had you ever thought about, you know, the men who are incarcerated here in California? Because you can't it's kind of hard to not know that, you know, since we incarcerate more people than some countries here in California.
Yeah.
And then the threat, since you're a black man too, of you know, of this particular phenomena, that you could be arrested. Doesn't matter if you did anything or not, because of the body that you occupy.
Exactly. I think about answer it in I guess sections. But the latter part about me feeling like I'm subject to being able to go down this road. I think about it all the time. I know that me as a man of my stature, I'm 35 years old. I'm about 275 pounds of nimble, athletic dancerness, and I'm a big guy. And I know that when I get off work late at night, because I work in restaurants and I work in the nightlife and clubs and stuff. And when I'm going to the bus or I'm walking to my car, and you know, a man of my stature walking down the street, I see people, you know, clutch their purses a little bit more tightly, or, you know, do a double take and look back and see how far back from them I am, and I notice stuff like that. I also have had in the back of my mind in any sort of potential altercations that, you know, I could have been in any situations in my life, which is, you know, which come up from time to time because we're human. I have to stop and, like, you know, weigh out, hey, you know, if police roll up and they see someone my size with my skin color and my texture of hair, they're probably going to possibly assume that, you know, I'm at fault regardless just because of the way America and a lot of folks with psyches are set up. As for whether or not I've given it too much thought, this, you know, particular subject matter for Johnny Walt Black and Brown, before that, I did a piece for Kendra Kimberl Barnes back in 2010 called Home Is That Way, Right? And, question mark, and it had to do with, you know, a family member who's very close to her, who I portrayed in it, who spent time in prison and was then out. And so that was probably more like in my life artistically and just personally the first time that I had ever really began to, like, dive into that kind of thought process. But once, you know, Joanna's so thorough, and she gave us, you know, video footage to watch and text to read about, you know, leading up to the 3 days leading up to an execution and how the whole, you know, structure of how things are run changes and shifts inside of the prison, just to, you know, keep the morale up so that you're less likely to have any sort of, like, unrest and like a riot with the inmates and such. And we've had lots of conversations and pleasure to watch. Antoine actually goes through a lethal injection that Matthew and I help facilitate with, you know, kind of toggling back and forth between being inmates and being other characters in the piece. And Antoine goes through this lethal injection and has this, you know, this statement that he's making, like, while he's being strapped in. And it's really, really powerful. And as, you know, Matthew and I are finished with the action of strapping him in, and we're just, you know, walking backwards slowly away from Antoine and leaving him there, he just, you know, goes into this series of, like a breathing cycle. And sometimes it gets so intense that, you know, he'll break down and cry, and we'll take a second and we'll talk about that and, like, what that is. And there's just a lot of really powerful images that are in here because Joanna's absolutely brilliant and super smart, and she can really get a lot of stuff out of us. And it's been a really growing, it's been a very growing experience, I think, for all of us. I know for sure for me, because it's not subject matter that I'm normally, you know, thinking about on a day-to-day basis. And so it's interesting to go in for, you know, 3-4 hour blocks of time for rehearsal and just, you know, check into that and, like, and go there for that moment.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah, thank you. Antoine, why don't you talk about this piece and your character and how you prepare for it, because it's really intense, you know, watching you die on stage, your character.
Well, my character is, his name is Charles Ratcher. And he was executed March 26, 1999. I had to really investigate his life. Toronto had me in a place where no other choreographer had put me in.